Once a month, we visit with our partners at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, SULA, for a segment we call Underground History. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov of SULA bring in people and stories about archaeology and the intricate and fascinating process of truly unearthing the past. This month, we get another story of underwater history as we talk about the finding earlier this year of the last slave ship, the one that delivered African people to southern Alabama decades after such shipments had been outlawed. Chelsea Rose is back in the studio with me. Chelsea, always good to see you.
Good to be here.
And on the end of the phone line, James Delgado, Senior Vice President at Search and Search 2O, who actually was here a couple of years ago when he was the former, when he was the Director of Marine Heritage at the Office of Marine Sanctuaries for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So James Delgado, it's welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for listening. Thanks for joining us,
Thank you.
So talk about maritime archaeologists. And are they a different breed from land-based ones?
Archaeology is archaeology. That being said, the environment that we work in as underwater archaeologists has its own challenges, but we practice the same science as Chelsea and others do. But in that, we also focus very strongly on the role of water, not just oceans, but lakes, rivers, and we look in particular at how our interactions with that water have shaped human society and how we've responded to it.
And I'd also like to add that the underwater archaeologists are the notorious partiers at the conferences. Versus the terrestrial archaeologists.
So archaeology is archaeology, but I want to get your perspective as somebody who generally does this on land, though. Is it a very different process?
Oh, well, the complications can be tenfold if you have to build a cofferdam to dry out an area to access the archaeology. Also, there's a lot of concerns with condition, like rapidly deteriorating artifacts and stuff like that. So, So there's a lot of other factors involved that we have to deal with when we're digging in the dirt, like the dried out dirt.
All right. So James, did the Clotilda figure to be a very difficult find at the outset? It sounds like it's the kind of thing that everybody knew about but didn't know where was.
Well, difficult is a relative term. There are difficult conditions, and that being said, there are also, you know, ways that you deal with that, particularly when you apply a methodical scientific approach. The one thing we did find, of course, is that the story of Clotilda was known, and in many ways, the ship was practically hidden in plain sight. Nobody really found Clotilda. We basically did a systematic survey and located a series of wrecks in the only unsurveyed area of the river where people had not looked for Clotilda. And there then found four wrecks that became three, two, and then finally one through a systematic process of evaluating that turned out to be the candidate that now, you know, is known to be Clotilda.
So I want to back up to, I want to get to the evaluation, and because it's some pretty intricate stuff you had to run tests on to figure it out, but I want to come back to the original story. I mean, as if slavery weren't repulsive enough, reading the account of why the Clotilda was doing what it was doing, when it was doing, adds a whole another layer of unsavory. I understand there was a bet involved with this?
There was a bet. And just to back up, let's look at the context of slavery. We are in the 400th anniversary year right now of the arrival of the first African American, first Africans to come to English-speaking America and as enslaved people. While their status was somewhat uncertain initially, this is the beginning of what would be centuries of enslavement in the United States, starting in colonial English America. But also, let's just also note that there was also enslavement in the Hispanic world and in the native world as well. But in this 400 years that we are now commemorating and studying and focusing on, as we should, the slave trade that arose, particularly the Middle Passage, which saw the movement of millions of people with over 15,000 known voyages, shifted by 1807 when the United States Congress, in response to humanitarian push, decided to ban the slave trade. Now, that didn't stop slavery. For 52 years, slavery continued in the United States after the slave trade ban went into effect in 1808. But people smuggled, they bypassed it, and slavery itself continued to be practiced in the United States. What also happened after the slave trade was banned was the Deep South opened up, particularly for the growth of cotton. And in many ways, cotton made cheaper by the cotton gin, but also through the use of forced slave labor, basically became the big commodity. It built the American economy. And as such, slavery expanded. So you have two forces going. You have a growing need for enslaved labor, and you have a system in place that has for centuries done this. You have people now becoming very rich with, you know, the investment and the values in the what would be the billions today. And with Britain importing nearly 80% of the American cotton market. So big cities are growing, particularly Mobile, in response to this. But you don't have a trade to keep bringing people in. You see roundups of people in northern states being sold down the river, literally, and pushed down. Families split up and people put on these large plantations to grow cotton. You have other ships sneaking people in. And by 1860, when the crime that was the Voyage of Clotilda happens, you basically have a group of guys sitting there in Mobile laughing and saying, I bet you we can pull this off. And so a bet is made. Clotilda is brought into the picture and under Captain William Foster is sent out on a voyage to go to the coast of Africa and pick up people.
Which they do in what is now Benin and bring them back to the Mobile area in Alabama. We're talking about the finding of the slave ship Clotilda with James Delgado, the senior vice president at Search 2O, the company that found or at least confirmed that the wreckage was in fact Clotilda. This is Underground History. Chelsea Rose from Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology is back with us. You can join our conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, James, the fact that it was illegal also aided in the played a big factor in the fact that it was hard to find Clotilda for many years afterward. Is that right?
The voyage ended in July of 1860 with Captain Foster arriving off the Gulf Coast of Mobile, not meeting the people that were there to offload his captives. And so he tucks into a back cove, downrigs his ship, disguises it a bit, takes a carriage into town, finds Captain Mayer, who is his co-conspirator and the man who placed the bet. They get a tug and they tow Clotilda in, past the main part of downtown to a backwater, go up the Spanish River, and at the mouth of the Spanish and the Mobile River is about 12 miles up from the city, in the dark. People are loaded onto Mayer's brother's steamship, and the cover of night, that steamship proceeds up the river nearly 50 miles to drop those people off and hide them. And Captain Foster then takes his schooner, as he says, and I burned it and sank it in 20 feet of water. What we've looked at as we've gone through, and I think just for a second, I need to point out that when we deal with historic archaeology, whether it's wet or dry, you often have a written record. That written record may be sparse at times. It may seem to indicate one thing. Oftentimes, I've found when you find the actual physical record, something sort of makes sense, a shoe drops. So what was very clear to us as we read the accounts, whether they were in the newspaper or the court records, because these guys were basically caught, even though the ship hadn't been, quote, found. And it went through a legal process, but the Civil War is coming, and these guys basically get off free. But what Foster did was basically drive the boat practically straight up the river a short distance and burn it, off of an area that he knew like the back of his hand. And I think pretty much everybody else knew where it was, too. Maybe not the exact spot, but more or less where it was. So it was hidden in plain sight. The marshal that was out hunting for it would become a Confederate within a matter of a very short time, as would the judge trying the case and others. So with all of that, that ship was there, but they hid it in what would become a ship graveyard, filled with a variety of other wrecks. And so the process that we had to go through was taking all of the written records, looking at the systematic search, and then examining every target, every wreck, come down to the final one, where we could then say, okay, all of this matches, and this has to be Clotilda. But again, coming back to another point, We didn't go hunt for Clotilda. We did a systematic survey of an area of the river where nobody had looked before and found a number of wrecks. And so the project was studying all of those, and in that process also saying, okay, here's one that stands out. That's Clotilda.
Were some of those other wrecks significant in their own way?
I think they're significant in that ship graveyards are pretty powerful sites. We oftentimes think of maritime archaeology as focusing on, say, a shipwreck or a lost city. But graveyards where things are discarded are pretty valuable for us, because it's not just to look at how ships were built over time. You're looking at questions about what people value, how they deal with things, how they recycle them. And in some cases, you'll find something that's been discarded actually has its own unique history. What the ship graveyard around 12 Mile Island said to us was basically painted a pretty detailed picture of coming out of that Civil War era, the changes and the shifts as Mobile adapted to a new economy, tied itself in as a port, brought other ships in, and I think one of the most amazing wrecks we found, we don't have a name for it, but it appears to be a West Coast, sort of California, or Oregon, Washington, maybe even British Columbia-built schooner of a type used in the lumber trades that was running out of use, no longer, you know, really viable on the West Coast. But a number of these were bought and brought out to Mobile around the time of the First World War and then afterwards as Mobile boomed in response to its own lumber trade. And so all of that in and by itself, you know, has been fascinating. But of course, Clotilda has its own unique story.
So do we know how many people were aboard the Clotilda, and when did Africatown and Mobile come to be?
There were, according to the captain, you had a group of 110 people that were loaded. That's always been the number that's been stated. There are now, as we begin to look back at the records, at least one person died on the voyage, and a recently discovered account from one other person, Radoshi, a woman who was on board, suggested perhaps two people died. What you have to think about in terms of the number of those people is not just the number. It's the circumstances in which they were held. These people were loaded, naked and with their heads shaved, into a small wooden schooner that was 86 feet long. The area in which they would be packed is roughly about 50 feet of that length inside the ship in a space that's no more than about, really, on average, 20 feet wide and several feet deep. And you pack all of those people in there. They're in close proximity to each other. There are no facilities other than buckets. There's no way to eat other than in large trays or buckets that are filled with basically with a mash in which molasses is poured. And that's what you're held in, sweating, vomiting, bleeding, everything for months as sealed in that hold you make your way across the Atlantic and to Mobile.
And then, so let's talk about the formation of Africatown and Mobile after the war.
After the war, the enslaved people who came out of the various plantations formed different groups. And one group of families came back to Mobile and settled on property, which they purchased through the labor that they were now being paid for. They purchased from Captain Mayer, the man who had been key in their enslavement, and created Africatown. It's a very strong family community. It's a very strongly church-centered community. And it is a community that, in many ways, followed what these people knew coming out of Africa. It was essentially Africa in Mobile as it started. And with that, what I see when we're there and we meet with the various descendants and the people there is this is a story that was there for them. It was up front. It was close. It was personal. They never forgot. And these stories have been passed down from generation to generation.
And what have people in Africatown told you, James Delgado, about their feelings, the significance to them of having the Clotilda's wreck actually found or identified anyway?
I can't speak for anyone there, and so many of the people in Africatown have powerfully gone out in response to this in the media and elsewhere and talked about it. The overall sense that I've had talking individually with people has been one in which I think they're glad it has been found. They're glad that this story is being told. But at the same time, what we should also be focusing on, and this is my view, is not just the ship. It's those people. It's what happened with their ancestors, and it's the community that has persisted and survives to this day, surviving through persistence, resistance, and very powerful, set of values, and moving forward. The resilience is a word that very much comes to mind. It's really been a humbling experience and a powerful experience, because more often than not, when you do this kind of work, you're not also, unless you work in certain types of sites, you're not working with a living community. And before this, my experience has been basically with people who had served on ships that we had found that had been lost, or people that had survived a shipwreck. Everything from the people I met after working on Titanic, who had been on Titanic as children, to the veterans who had been on board USS Arizona when it blew up on December 7th, and other sites as well.
So in addition to this being a tangible remnant of this horrific event and representative of this moment in history, are there other material culture traces of the enslaved people that will help tell their story and fill in some of the gaps?
Colleagues working in the historical archaeology side of things have been working and digging in Africatown to the College of William and Mary, and I think that in and by itself, is very powerful and very important. The other thing I would note is that other colleagues have worked to capture memory and to also write the history. There are some very good books that are out there, and in particular, I'm a big fan of Sylvia Ndiaye's Dreams of Africa in Alabama, a very good book, as well as Natalie Robertson's The Slave Ship Flotilla and the Making of Africatown, The Spirit of Our Ancestors. And then, of course, the now published Barracoon by Zora Neale Hurston, who famously interviewed Kuzula, or Cujo Lewis, who was one of the last survivors.
So we have to go in about a minute here, James Delgado. I've heard you say or seen your quotes about talking about the wreck is in poor condition. I mean, we're not talking about, can it be preserved in some form as is?
I think it can be preserved as is. I think that what next has to happen is a detailed study as we delve deeper into the wreck, understanding its condition, what might be possible, as well as unlocking more of the stories that are sealed in the mud.
All right, James Delgado, thank you so much for joining us once again. Senior Vice President now at Search 2O. We talked to him 4 years ago when he was still with the Office of Marine Sanctuaries for NOAA. Good to talk to you. Take care.
Thank you.
Chelsea Rose, always good to see you from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology.
Thanks.
See you in a month for another edition of Underground History here on the Jefferson Exchange. Talk to the rest of you in just a minute here as we head into the second hour of the Exchange. Stay tuned.